to the reading of the Des Moines Register for Sunday, July 26, 2020. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Things are changing very quickly, and IRIS wants to make sure we provide our listeners with as much information as we can. In order to do that, we've changed our program schedule completely. This schedule will air statewide on all platforms until further notice. We will also include information about resources in your community during each paper. You'll still hear your Des Moines Register each day at 9 a.m., 6 p.m., and 1 a.m. Please listen closely to the following changes for all other newspapers. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m., Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m., Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. until noon. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon, 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m., 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m., Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m., 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. And the Midweek Shopping Cart will be read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. Recordings of all newspapers will be available on our podcast page. Just go to iowaradioreading.org, click Listen Now, then click Listen to IRIS Podcasts. The papers are organized by region. Each paper will be available for 7 days. As things continue to change, we will announce schedule changes each hour at 56 minutes past the hour going forward. Keep yourself safe and thank you for listening. And now, let's take a look at today's weather. Our AccuWeather forecast calls for humid today with a couple of showers and a heavy thunderstorm. Storms can bring flash flooding and damaging winds, winds from the southwest at 7 to 14 miles per hour. In the Des Moines area today, showers and a heavier thunderstorm today, winds from the southwest at 6 to 16 miles per hour. A heavy thunderstorm early tonight. Expect a high today of 91 degrees with a low of 69. On Monday, a high of 85, a low of 64 and not as hot, and Tuesday, a high of 86 with a low of 68, mostly sunny and pleasant. Across the state today, warm with a couple of showers and a heavy thunderstorm, winds from the southwest at 8 to 16 miles per hour. And on Monday, a morning shower in places, otherwise considerable cloudiness, winds from the north at 7 to 14 miles per hour. Our sunrise today was at 6:04 a.m. and will set at 8:38 p.m. The moonrise at 12:40 p.m. and there is no moonset. And now let's take a look at the first story and the headlines in today's Des Moines Register. Some evictions violate CARES Act, and Iowans wary of changes in wind energy rule. And in USA Today's network, the good old days. Ian Richardson writes about some evictions violate CARES Act. We'll start with that article. With multiple protections set to expire, Iowa service agencies are preparing for the next wave of ejections. Some tenants at Grace Lake Apartments in Des Moines were behind on their rent, owing their landlord as much as $2,800, but they should have had more time. On May 6th, as Iowa remained under an emergency proclamation preventing most evictions, property management sent a handful of tenants notice that they would be evicted unless they paid their balances or made arrangements for partial payment. On May 14th and 15th, Grays Lake Apartments followed through, filing for at least nine evictions in Polk County Small Claims Court. The rent deficits ran from $1,400 to $2,800, according to court filings. 2 months later, after Polk County resumed eviction hearings for non-payment of rent after a long hiatus due to the coronavirus, five of the tenants failed to appear for their hearings. By default, the court issued an eviction judgment. But their cases should never have made it before a judge. Grays Lake Apartments is among many Iowa rental properties financed with a federally backed mortgage, meaning it falls under a provision in the CARES Act that prohibits landlords from filing eviction cases against tenants who can't pay their rent. That means the eviction judgments reached earlier this month were not only in violation of Iowa's eviction moratorium, but also the federal protections, which expired Saturday. Even after the federal protections expired, landlords must give residents a 30-day notice before filing an eviction in court. The Grace Lake tenants weren't alone. According to Iowa Legal Aid, which is analyzing trends in Polk County eviction filings, 22 eviction judgments issued in Polk County Small Claims Court from July 13th through the 17th involved filings that violated either the CARES Act or Iowa's statewide eviction moratorium, which ended in late May. That's 40% of the judgments. "We are very concerned about this," said Alex Cornia, litigation director for the Iowa Legal Aid, which offers free civil legal assistance to low-income Iowans and other vulnerable groups. The purpose of the moratorium was to give people a chance to catch up, so it not only prohibited filing evictions, but also prohibited giving the pre-suit notices requiring payment in 3 days. A rush of eviction cases is bombarding Iowa's small claims courts 2 months after Governor Kim Reynolds allowed the state's eviction moratorium to expire. And as a result, more Iowans are losing stable housing, even as COVID-19 cases and hospitalization surges in parts of the state. Along with the federal eviction moratorium, which the Urban Institute estimates covered 28% of rental units nationwide, the end of July also brings the end of the boosted federal unemployment benefits that advocates believe have helped many families make the rent. Emily Benfer, chair of the American Bar Association's Task Force Committees on Evictions, told CNBC on July 10th that she estimates 20 million to 28 million of the country's renters could be at risk of eviction. In a typical year, the United States sees about 1.5 million eviction judgments, according to data from the Evictions Lab at Princeton University. In Iowa, the U.S. Census Bureau's weekly Household Pulse survey estimates more than 1 in 5 households faces housing insecurity, meaning they either missed their last month's rent or mortgage payment or have very little confidence that they can afford the next one. In Iowa, some renters have had difficulties connecting with rental assistance programs, either through lack of awareness or delays in how long it took federal funding to reach local service agencies. "I am confident that if every single person that needed help reached out, we wouldn't have enough people or money to help," said Ann Bacon, executive director of Impact Community Action Partnership in Des Moines, which has distributed more than $1 million in rental and mortgage assistance since the beginning of June. In Polk County, eviction hearings from July 13th through the 17th resulted in 74 families losing their homes, according to an analysis of eviction filings by Iowa Legal Aid. The eviction judgments come as Polk and several other counties across the state reopened in-person eviction hearings for the first time since Reynolds' March emergency proclamation that suspended evictions unless tenants posed a clear and present danger on the property. Some Iowa counties had conducted hearings via phone or virtual meeting programs before July 13th. In Polk County, 255 eviction cases went to hearings from July 13th through the 17th. Of those cases, 55 ended with the judge ordering an eviction. Before the pandemic, Polk County averaged about 28 evictions a week, according to the National Evictions Database at Eviction Lab, which includes city, county, and state-level eviction data through 2016. Another 19 Polk County eviction cases did not result in a formal eviction, but ended with an agreement that the tenants move out, according to Legal Aid's analysis. Cornia said such agreements are common in Polk County, but in many cases they gave tenants only 2 to 6 days to leave, which is often less than they would have had if a judge had formally evicted them. Since there is no centralized real-time evictions for the state, it's unclear how many people are being evicted statewide. Advocates say the number of eviction filings has, so far, appeared to be slightly less than anticipated. The spike, they say, is due at least in part to the backlog of cases that grew as Iowa landlords were unable to evict tenants for months. "It's a little lower than we had expected," Cornia said. "But the other thing to keep in mind is that the CARES Act moratorium still covers people until the 25th of July. When Grays Lake Apartments sent resident John Kano a 3-day notice in May, court filings show he owed $2,776.17 in back rent. At the time, Kano said he wasn't able to make payments. He was laid off from his warehouse job in March and had trouble collecting unemployment benefits. "I've been worried about how to take care of this," he said. Reached on Wednesday by a Des Moines Register reporter, Grays Lake Apartments property manager Chris Coffey said he had believed that the evictions he filed were legal, as long as he waited until late August to file the paperwork with the Polk County Sheriff's Office to have the tenants removed. Coffey said his original hope was that the eviction process would be resolved through mediation, but when 5 of the tenants didn't show up for their court hearings, he proceeded with the evictions. After his discussion with the Register, Coffey said he would file a motion to dismiss the cases and would start over once the CARES Act protections expire. Thursday morning, he said the motions were approved. "Obviously, I don't want to be in violation," he said. Kano said he was hired back at his job 3 weeks ago and wants to work out a payment plan with the apartment's management. Since May 22nd, Iowa courts have required landlords to submit a CARES Act verification form with each eviction filing that specifies any federal connections to their property. The form is meant to weed out cases that fall under the federal moratorium, like the ones at Grays Lake Apartments. But the Grays Lake eviction cases were filed 7 days before Iowa courts began mandating those forms. Iowa Judicial Branch Communications Director Steve Davis said the judicial branch is aware of the issue, but that it would be inappropriate to comment on pending cases. Iowa is far from the only state that has had issues with filings that violate federal protections, said Eric Dunn, director of litigation with the National Housing Law Project. Dunn said no national agency is tasked with oversight of the CARES Act protections, meaning some cases could skate through the courts unnoticed. State and local agencies have been working for months to use CARES Act funding to create rental and mortgage assistance programs. Advocates say they're hoping they have enough resources to withstand another spike in evictions when the federal protections expire. "We had hoped that these rental assistance programs would be there to be able to help catch people who don't have some kind of legal defense to their eviction," Cornea said. "That hasn't necessarily played out that way, which is disappointing." At Impact Community Action Partnership in Des Moines, Bacon said rental assistance is always in demand, but the phones have been ringing more often since May. Impact, one of the key groups providing rental assistance in Polk, Boone, Jasper, Marion, and Warren counties, used $1 million of CARES Act grants to provide rental and mortgage assistance starting June 1st. By the time the program was ready, it had a waiting list of 700 people. By July 10th, the $1 million was gone. For the next 6 days, Bacon said, Impact had no federal money to distribute for rental assistance. "That doesn't sound like very long," he said, "but when you're holding an eviction notice, that's a very, very long time." Impact has since received a new infusion of federal funding for rental assistance through a partnership with the City of Des Moines. Many of the applicants are people who have lost their jobs or had hours reduced to virus-related business closures, Bacon said. Cornea said most of the evictions in Polk County during the first week of the hearings, nearly 90%, were due to non-payment of rent. Some tenants have also faced delays in receiving unemployment benefits, he said. The breakdown in systems across the board is really taking a toll. Iowa's largest pandemic-related housing assistance program is the statewide eviction and foreclosure protection program, which Reynolds announced 2 days after lifting Iowa's eviction moratorium. The $22 million program provides up to 4 months of rent or mortgage payments to Iowans in need of assistance, but there are limitations. Tenants must prove a COVID-related loss of income and cannot be receiving the additional $600 per month in federal unemployment benefits. As of Thursday morning, a combined $1.87 million had been distributed to 833 Iowa renters, according to data from the Iowa Finance Authority. Another $77,273 had gone to 36 homeowners. IFA Communications Director Ashley Jared said she believes once the supplemental federal unemployment runs out, the number of people seeking assistance through the program will increase sharply. Iowa cities with populations above 50,000 have also received a combined $12.3 million in coronavirus-related community development block grant and emergency solutions grant funding, which some have used to set up rental assistance and homeless prevention programs. The IFA last week also began distributing approximately $9 million in federal grants for homeless assistance and is developing a plan for a second wave of $11 million in federal funding. The Iowa Economic Development Authority will also receive approximately $24 million in community development block grant funding to distribute. Agency officials said they are doing what they can to prepare for an influx of requests as federal benefits expire. "Right now, we're kind of building the plane as we're flying it," said Jan Zalecki, program director at Home Incorporated, which also received federal funding to administer assistance. "Nobody really knows what's going to happen there." And in our second article, Danielle Eller writes, Iowans wary of changes in wind energy rule. Proposal could lead to seizure of private land by utilities and developers. Jean Learberg worries that proposed changes to the state's rules for building wind and solar farms would let developers and big utilities grab part of his 310-acre farm and 40-acre timber lot for their renewable energy projects. If someone a mile away wants to put turbines up, that's their business, said Learberg, who lives near Hubbard in central Iowa. I think they're getting paid pretty well to do it, but I don't want them on or near my property. Learberg and hundreds of other Iowans have written the Iowa Utilities Board, expressing concern that the proposed rules would give large companies pursuing renewable energy projects the power to take their land without their consent through a process called eminent domain. The companies, for their own reasons, also are wary of the change. The State Board, which has received about 550 public comments on the proposed rules, says Iowa law already gives developers access to eminent domain when energy projects are required to have a generating certificate. Large wind projects in Iowa so far have avoided using that requirement, but that would change under the proposal. Big wind projects would need state certificates, and critics say that process would prompt increased use of eminent domain. It's extremely upsetting to think that an energy company could step in, dig up my farm, and plant a wind turbine where I don't want one, said Mary Ellen Fisher, who owns farmland in Audubon County. Her family agreed to one turbine, but doesn't want more. Some groups say it's unlikely renewable energy projects could qualify for eminent domain under Iowa law, but they back greater safeguards. The proposed rules also would shift decisions about whether wind and solar projects should be built from county supervisors to the three-person Iowa Utilities Board. The governor appoints the utility board members, who require state senate confirmation. The move comes at a time when some county leaders are imposing or considering restrictions or moratoriums on wind development. Jack Seward, a Washington County supervisor, says renewable energy project decisions need to be left to local government. An elected board 120 miles from the project at hand will not have the priorities most important to the people impacted, and should not be the final authority for what goes on between neighbors and in neighborhoods, Seward wrote to the state board. Although the board says the change would streamline the approval process, the proposed rules also have failed to gain favor with big investor-owned utilities or wind energy developers. They're concerned the board's proposal would create unneeded regulations, increased renewable energy costs and delays, and hinder development and construction. Over about 20 years, companies have invested $19 billion in wind energy in Iowa and deploy about 9,000 people, proponents say. Iowa now gets the largest percentage of its energy from wind, surpassing coal last year. Amshore, a Texas developer that's working on a $200 million project in Kossuth County, warned that such a drastic change in policy could cast uncertainty on billions of dollars in existing and planned wind energy development projects. Moreover, the lost revenues to landowners, state and local governments, and school districts across Iowa would be colossal, the company wrote the board. So why the change? Wind farms in Iowa can generate hundreds of megawatts of electricity, but the state weighs only whether turbines send more than 25 megawatts to a single gathering line, even though a project can have several of them. If each gathering line carries less than 25 megawatts, utilities and developers need only gain approval from county supervisors to develop a wind farm. Most of the state's wind farms have been developed under that approach. But the proposed rules say the Iowa Utilities Board would look at the power generated in the entire area of a proposed project, regardless of the number of megawatts on each gathering line. That shift would require developers of utility-sized projects to go to the state board for generating certificates and approval. Chicago-based Invin Energy says it's unclear why the board has proposed the change. There is a very real risk of fixing a process that is not broken, the renewable energy developer said in comments. The American Wind Energy Association and other industry proponents told the board that Iowa's light regulatory touch has created a climate for the state's wind industry to grow and thrive. Iowa's investor-owned utilities, along with wind developers, have built an estimated 5,100 wind turbines, mostly in rural Iowa. The projects annually generate $61 million in tax revenues for local governments and $69 million in land lease payments to farms and landowners, the group said. Last year, Iowa received 42% of its electricity from wind, the largest share of any state, surpassing coal at 35%. Wind energy's rapid development also has created a growing group of opponents concerned about the noise from wind turbines, light flickering from the turning blades, and health problems they link to the turbines. Learberg worries that the noise from the turbines would scare away wildlife. He and his wife have worked for dozens of years reforesting 40 acres that are now home to turkey, deer, eagles, and other animals. The possibility of wind developers having eminent domain powers worries him. "I'm afraid if they circumvent the supervisors and leave it up to the utilities board, we lose local control completely," he said. The utilities board says it has never granted, and no wind farm developer has ever requested, the power of eminent domain for wind turbines. Companies like MidAmerican Energy and Alliant Energy have found landowners willing to lease them land for their growing investment in wind and solar projects. MidAmerican firmly believes the current approach, which relies on voluntary landowner participation and local approval, is the superior approach, the Des Moines utility said in its comments. But the company, owned by billionaire investor Warren Buffett, said if the board pushes forward with statewide siting rules, it should come with eminent domain powers for companies. The proposed rules, MidAmerican said, give companies less flexibility when siting turbines, and they may need eminent domain to complete a project. "That's not our preferred approach," the company said. Should the board act as the final authority for siting decisions, inevitably there will be landowners whose personal interest will be found lacking relative to societal interest, and eminent domain will be necessary, the company said. The Iowa Farm Bureau Federation, a longtime advocate for property owners' rights, said it believes that most renewable energy projects would be unable to meet the requirements to use eminent domain. "It would be a rare occurrence," said the Farm Bureau, which this year supported statewide regulations that guide where large-scale wind and solar farms can be built, given concerns about the loss of valuable farmland to renewable energy projects. Many Iowans have not been reassured. Landowners should be able to say yes or no to a project without a state board trying to circumvent those rights, Michael Collish of Whittemore told the board. "Perhaps we need to take up protesting. It seems to be effective." Jennifer Easler, Iowa state-appointed consumer advocate for utilities issues, said the board should address residents' concerns and revise the rules to explain when it would grant eminent domain authority for renewable energy generation projects. Utilities, wind developers, county officials, and residents told the state board that decisions about large wind projects should remain with local leaders. In those initial comments, whether a few lines or many pages, nearly everyone, renewables developers, utilities, counties, equipment manufacturers, even local objectors, agrees that the current familiar county-based system makes more sense in most cases than a new, fundamentally different centralized system, Invent Energy wrote. Iowa's current approach has survived repeated legal challenges, several groups said, and an Iowa Supreme Court ruling last year affirmed the state's policies. Apex Clean Energy, a Virginia company that plans to build a wind project in Boone and Hamilton counties, said it's concerned the proposed rules would require it to go through a new approval process after years of work. Several companies urged the board to expand the projects that would be grandfathered or eligible to get approval under the current process. For Great Pathfinder and likely other pending developments as well, this is a worst-case scenario, and this is Apex's single biggest concern with the proposed rules, the company wrote. In addition to the wasted resources, the much bigger issue is the delay this would create. "Having to start over in a new generating certificate process could jeopardize commercial agreements, tax credit qualifications, and accordingly the financing for this and other projects," the company said. David and Shelley Marsh, wind opponents who live in Dexter, compared the board's renewable energy efforts to lawmakers' decision in 2002 to set statewide standards for locating confined animal feeding operations. Among critics' complaints, manure from the facilities runs off from farm fields and pollutes Iowa waterways. "To state you are streamlining the application process and removing the burden from the county level is the same verbiage used when the state took control of hog confinements from the counties," the couple wrote the board. "This act of state control has turned into a disaster for certain counties and have damaged some counties beyond repair." But Joshua Mendelbaum, an environmental law and policy center attorney, said renewable energy proponents are concerned about a patchwork of requirements across Iowa's 99 counties. For example, Madison and Hardin counties have approved moratoriums on new wind development, and Adair County capped how many turbines could be installed, effectively stopping new construction. You could end up with 99 different sets of regulations to navigate, which could be very onerous and limit development, Mandelbaum said. That's potentially an advantage for the board's proposed rulemaking and providing universal guidance and level of certainty. Mandelbaum said it's unclear what step the Iowa Utilities Board might take with the proposed rules, whether the board will decide to seek more comments, revise the rules, propose new rules, or just drop them. They have a lot of flexibility, he said, adding that he would be surprised if the board seeks to finalize the proposed rules, given widespread opposition. Ben Fox from the Associated Press writes, U.S. taps Border Patrol for policing protests. Some ask whether DHS is the right agency for the job. They are the most highly trained members of the Border Patrol, agents who confront drug traffickers along the U.S.-Mexican border and track down dangerous fugitives in rugged terrain. One day last week, they were in a far different setting, a city park in Portland, Oregon, looking for two people suspected of throwing rocks and bottles at officers guarding the downtown federal courthouse. Beyond the debate over whether the federal response to the Portland protest encroaches on local authority, another question arises, whether the Department of Homeland Security, with its specialized national security focus, is the right agency for the job. It's not just the Border Patrol Tactical Unit that has been called to duty in Portland. DHS has dispatched air marshals as well as the Customs and Border Protection Special Response Team and even members of the Coast Guard. The Department of Homeland Security was never intended as a national police force, let alone a presidential militia, said Peter Vincent, a former general counsel for U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, which is also an agency within DHS. The deployment of DHS agents and officers is legal, both under existing law and an executive order President Donald Trump signed June 26 to protect federal property and monuments. But it has made the agency, created to improve the nation's response to terrorism, a target of widespread criticism. Congress plans to delve into the issue Friday when the House Homeland Security Committee holds a hearing on the federal response to the protest in Portland and Trump's announcement that he plans to send federal agents to Chicago and Albuquerque, New Mexico, to help combat rising crime while making law and order a central theme of his re-election campaign. Americans across the country are watching what the administration is doing in Portland with horror and revulsion and are wondering if their cities could be President Trump's next targets, said Representative Benny Thompson, a Mississippi Democrat who is chairman of the committee. As of Monday, there were 114 federal agents and officers deployed to downtown Portland, according to an affidavit from Gabriel Russell, the regional director of the Federal Protective Service, the DHS component that provides security for federal buildings. Protests have been taking place in Portland since May 26, but the federal agents kept a defense posture by staying inside federal buildings until July 3, Russell said in an affidavit, filed in response to a lawsuit by the American Civil Liberties Union seeking protections for journalists and other legal observers covering the demonstrations. That night, according to Russell, protesters attempted to set fire to the federal courthouse, and DHS deployed a rapid development force as part of Operation Diligent Valor. That same night, Trump stood before Mount Rushmore and accused protesters around the country who have pushed for racial justice of engaging in a merciless campaign to wipe out our history. He later criticized officials in Portland for allowing demonstrations to get totally out of control. The officers deploying to Portland are highly trained, and many wear camouflage because that's their duty uniform on the southwest border, according to acting DHS Secretary Chad Wolf, responding to charges of a militarized response to the protests. In addition to their previous training, they took a 90-minute online course on the mission and jurisdiction of the Federal Protective Service, police powers, and criminal regulations, according to a course description provided to the Associated Press. Richard Klein, Principal Deputy Director of the Protective Services, told reporters that DHS officers are given additional training to ensure they act within guidelines established by the Justice Department as they assist an organization that was quickly overwhelmed by violent protesters. Wolfe also defended tactics used as tear gas, rubber bullets, and having officers sweep people off the street in unmarked vehicles, evoking images of a secret police force. "We are only targeting and arresting those who have been identified as committing criminal acts, like any other law enforcement agency does across the country every single day of the week," he said. On Wednesday, agents from the Border Patrol Tactical Unit, known as BORTAC, set out from the federal courthouse just after midnight in pursuit of two people in dark clothing and carrying makeshift shields suspected of throwing rocks and bottles at officers, according to court records. The agents struggled with the two, eventually restraining them and turning them over to the Federal Protective Service. One, a 19-year-old man, was charged with felony assault of an officer. At least 28 officers have been injured, and officers have made at least 43 arrests, mostly for misdemeanors. While the use of BORTAC officers in this environment is unusual, it's not unprecedented, said Michael Fisher, a former senior official with the agency and a member of the unit. BORTAC officers have been used to serve warrants on suspects considered dangerous, protected emergency personnel during natural disasters, and were sent to Los Angeles during the 1992 riots, Fisher said. What was happening in Portland is the police were not enforcing the laws, and it was just escalating, and that's the reason it's gone on well over 50 days now, said Fisher, who now runs a security company. Local officials have in turn accused DHS of inflaming the situation, an argument bolstered by the fact that protests grew larger as controversy intensified over the tactics of the federal agents. Former DHS officials concede the agency has worked with state and local law enforcement before, with the consent and cooperation of local authorities. But in Oregon, officials have accused the federal government of inflaming the situation and asked it to withdraw. Vincent, who left ICE in 2014 and now works as a consultant, said some current officials are extraordinarily uncomfortable with what they have been asked to do in Portland. And I guess here is a related article. Feds use tear gas to clear Portland protest. Thousands of protesters gathered outside the federal courthouse in Portland, Oregon, into the early hours of Saturday, shooting fireworks at the buildings as plumes of tear gas dispensed by U.S. agents lingered above. The demonstration went until federal agents entered the crowd around 2:30 a.m. and marched in a line down the street, clearing remaining protesters with tear gas at close range. They also extinguished a large fire in the street outside the courthouse. Portland has been roiled by nightly protests for 2 months following the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. President Donald Trump said he sent federal agents to Oregon's largest city to halt the unrest, but state and local officials say they are making the situation worse. The clashes in Portland have further inflamed the nation's political tensions and triggered a crisis over the limits of federal power, as Trump moves to send U.S. officers to other Democratic-led cities he says are violent. Late Friday, a federal judge denied a request by Oregon's Attorney General to restrict the actions of federal police. The Federal Protective Service had declared the gathering in Portland that began Friday evening as an unlawful assembly and said that officers had been injured. As the crowd dispersed, someone was found stabbed nearby, Portland police said. The person was taken to a hospital and a suspect was taken into custody. Early Friday night, the protest had drawn various organized groups, including healthcare workers' protests, teachers against tyrants, lawyers for Black Lives, and the Wall of Bombs. As the crowd grew, authorities estimate there were 3,000 present at the peak of the protest. People were heard chanting "Black Lives Matter" and "Feds Go Home" to the sound of drums. As the clouds of gas floated down the street, protesters would swiftly regroup and return to chant and shake the fence that separates the people on the street from the federal agents and the courthouse. It was unclear whether anyone was arrested during the protests. From Los Angeles, officials say men's rights lawyer killed attorney. Authorities believe a men's rights lawyer shot and killed a fellow attorney in California in the days before he attacked a federal judge's family in New Jersey and died by suicide, officials announced Friday. Roy Den Hollander, age 72, was found dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound on July 20th, the day after the ambush shooting that killed U.S. District Judge Esther Salas's 20-year-old son and wounded her husband. Salas was in another part of the house and unharmed. Investigators said Wednesday that they had evidence linking the New Jersey shooting to the July 11th death of lawyer Mark Angelucci in San Bernardino County, California. Dan Hollander, and Angelucci, age 52, were involved in separate federal lawsuits seeking to force the U.S. government to require all young women to join men in registering for a possible military draft. Dan Hollander's lawsuit, filed in 2015 on behalf of a woman in New Jersey, was assigned to SELAS. He withdrew as the lawyer in the case a year ago after being diagnosed with cancer. When he died, Dan Hollander had items related to both SELAS and New York State Chief Judge Janet M. DeFoy. He also had a typed document that contained information about on a dozen or so other women, some of them judges. Two sources with first-hand knowledge of the material told the Associated Press. Three judges known to be on the list declined to comment or did not return messages from the AP seeking comment. In California, Dan Hollander arrived at a train station in San Bernardino on July 7th and rented a car, the county sheriff's office said Friday in a news release. Authorities released a photo of a man who was wearing a mask at the train station carrying items away from a food stand. Officials said Dan Hollander drove the rental car to Angelucci's home, where he shot and killed him. Dan Hollander drove away and boarded a train out of California from Union Station to Los Angeles. A photo at the station shows a man, again masked, wheeling a suitcase. It was not immediately clear if Dan Hollander took a train across the country or if the same gun was used in the shootings and the suicide. In both the California and New Jersey attacks, the suspect appeared to pose as a delivery driver, a law enforcement official previously told the AP. The official could not discuss an ongoing investigation publicly and spoke to the AP on the condition of anonymity. Dan Hollander described himself as an anti-feminist attorney who filed lawsuits challenging the constitutionality of ladies' night promotions at bars and nightclubs, and sued Columbia University for providing women's studies classes, and sued news organizations over what he said was biased coverage. In more than 2,000 pages of often racist writings posted online, Dan Hollander had sharply criticized SELAS and other female judges. He also wrote about wanting to use the rest of his time on Earth to even the score with his perceived enemies, using cowboy justice. Also from the Associated Press, Trump plays on fears in suburbs, says he'll protect those areas from racial unrest. President Donald Trump last week sent a message to the suburban housewives of America, and in a single tweet summed up his strategy for shoring up support in communities critical to his re-election chances. Scare them. Biden will destroy your neighborhood and your American dream. I will preserve it and make it even better, he wrote. In tweets, campaign ads, and new policies, Trump is trying to win over suburbanites by promising to protect their beautiful neighborhoods from the racial unrest that has gripped some U.S. cities this summer. He sent federal agents to stem violence in cities, warned of a way of life being obliterated, and raised the prospect of falling property values. It's a strategy with deep roots in presidential politics, racist overtones, and some record of success. But even some GOP strategists and Republican voters note it doesn't account for the rapid demographic changes in the suburbs and may be misreading the top concerns of voters he's trying to retain. I think he's just throwing stuff against the wall and seeing what sticks, said Linda Abate, an unemployed bartender in this working-class suburb about 45-minute drive from Philadelphia. Abate says she voted for Trump in 2016 and is likely, but has not yet decided, to do so again. But she has more pressing things to worry about than threats of lawlessness in her quiet borough, namely the looming expiration of enhanced federal unemployment benefits. The commuter towns and leafy developments circling Philadelphia and other U.S. cities, areas with increasing racial diversity and a growing number of college-educated voters, have been a clear source of trouble for the president and his party. Republicans lost more than three dozen suburban House districts in 2018, when suburban voters backed Democrats by 11-point margin, according to AP VoteCast polling. Recent polls show Democrats' presumptive nominee, former Vice President Joe Biden, holding that edge, with a 9% margin in the recent Washington Post ABC News poll and an 11% margin in a recent Fox News poll. Both surveys showed an especially wide advantage for the presumptive Democratic nominee among suburban women. That's a dire prospect for the president. Republicans have long relied on finding upper-income and white voters in the growing suburbs to build on their base in rural America and win elections. but those voters have been harder to win over in the Trump era, forcing the GOP to move further away from cities into less populated exurbs and shrinking small towns in search of votes. In recent weeks, Trump has tried to regain his footing. His campaign launched ads claiming inaccurately that Biden wants to defund the police, a rallying cry for some of the protesters who took to the streets after George Floyd's death in May. He revoked an Obama-era housing policy aimed at ending racial disparities in suburbs, saying it would lead to crime and lower home values. And last week, Trump announced he was activating federal agents to fight crime in Chicago and Albuquerque, New Mexico, after sending agents to Portland, Oregon, where local officials say their presence has exacerbated tensions between protesters and police. The Trump campaign believes these moves will resonate with both suburbanites and older voters who may be rattled by the violent images and turned off by calls to restructure police departments. There is some evidence to support that tack. The Washington Post ABC News survey found that 58% of the suburban voters opposed reducing funding for police and spending the money instead on social services, while 37% supported it. If we don't have law and order in this country, we don't have a country. It's outrageous to let this stuff go on, said Gloria Doak, a 70-year-old Trump backer in Bucks County, where Democrat Hillary Clinton only narrowly beat Trump 4 years ago. But recent polls have also found strong support in the suburbs for the broader push for racial justice and Black Lives Matter movement, a reminder that suburbs are becoming more politically complex and diverse battlegrounds. In 2018, 1 in 4 suburban voters identified as non-white, according to the AP VoteCast. That includes Robert Jackson, a 39-year-old Black man and a Democrat who moved 4 years ago to the suburbs from Philadelphia with his family in search of better schools. He says he saw plenty of Trump signs then around his hometown of Lansdale in Montgomery County. Now he thinks many of his neighbors who voted for Trump have buyer's remorse. Suburbanites took a gamble on him and it didn't pay off, said Jackson. Christine Matthews, a GOP pollster and Trump critic, said the president's law and order strategy is based on an outdated idea of suburbia as the overwhelming white communities of 50 years ago. He doesn't have any idea what the suburbs are, she said. Others linked it directly to Richard Nixon's Southern strategy, which played on white voters' racism to consolidate Republican control of the South for generations to come. He's gone to the well, gone to the old playbook, but it's a much different playing field now, said Fletcher McClellan, a political scientist at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania. Still in Texas, where Democrats are trying to flip several suburban House seats, Cynthia Rossi said, it's not far-fetched to think that Trump's dark warnings will resonate with her neighbors in suburban Round Rock outside of Austin. Trump won this district on the outskirts of liberal Austin by 13 points in 2016. Just 2 years later, Republican Representative John Carter only narrowly escaped defeat. Rossi, a 57-year-old yoga instructor and mother of three, called Trump's tweet directed to the suburban housewives of America offensive, to suggest that suburban housewives are a bunch of pearl clutchers who are afraid of everything. We're smarter than that, she said. Turning over to the Metro and Iowa section, headlines, Pie Nasty, Team Register wins Rhubarb Rumble 5, and Iowa tied for fourth nationally in census response. Urbandale's Rolling Green Elementary starts school year with online learning, and protester arrested on leak charge released. Starting with Pie Nasty, Team Register wins Rhubarb Rumble 5. All participants in annual pie-eating contest have home kitchen advantage. From Your Home USA. The competitors formed ranks, not at folding tables on a small Iowa Main Street, but in Zoom windows. They supported not full Lycra suits and a musty smell of sweat and sunscreen, but pandemic hair and a funky fragrance of Work From Home Day 10,047. They came with a ravenous hunger, not just for the flaky perfection of pie, but for the honor of winning Rhubarb Rumble 5, the annual pie-eating contest pitting journalists at the Des Moines Register against National Public Radio reporters in a one-slice-per-person relay race for greatness. And when the crumbs settled, I am thrilled to report that Team Register has again not only claimed gluttonous glory, but ensured the Golden Roller stays in Iowa for another year. With our fingers licked and our blueberry filling stained chins held high, the Register has officially established a pie nastiness, winning 4 battles to their 1 fluke. All I can say is hats off to the register team, said a dejected Scott Fork user Horsley, leader of Team No Pie Refused, aka Team NPR. It was an impressive performance, and to think this crusty combat almost didn't happen. In April, our host, the Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa, better known as RAGBRAI, was canceled due to concerns about the spreading coronavirus pandemic, leaving the fifth edition of the TART tradition in peril. But Horsley and Team Register, led by Brian Pecan Powers, refused to stand by as bellies remained empty and competitive energy unexerted on sugar sweats, a saccharine cousin to the meat sweats. The team rallied, vowing to do battle with hands and forks, I guess. I roll, Scott, I roll, in the social distance way in which we've all recently become accustomed. It's important that cultural institutions such as this can endure despite all the challenges this year, Kyle Pioa's prize winner, Munson gushed. Founded in 2015, the speed pie eating began when Munson, a former Iowa columnist at the Register, challenged NPR's No Pie Refuse team to defend their name in an official capacity in a 3-on-3 battle. They didn't, and the Register won with a clean sweep that year and in 2017. Both teams agreed to a truce in 2016 as eaters were otherwise engaged in election coverage. Then came the dark days of 2018 when Register eaters were embarrassed by Camelia Domonsky, a business reporter at NPR and vegan weighing 100 pounds soaking wet. Although a nail-biter to the end, the Register's trusty closer Michael Meringue Moraine was bested by Dominski, who didn't seem to breathe or bite, but rather inhaled her slice, a response scientists believe to her body ingesting lard for the first time in years. The Register regained the title last year, though the victory wasn't as sweet. Dominski, the Carrie Strug of pie eating, wasn't in the competition. But in 2020, the rivalry was back on as Moraine and Dominski lined up, metaphorically, across from one another. Moraine had been fasting for weeks in preparation, he said, and eating sweets while rage listening to NPR in hopes of triggering a Pavlovian response. Training aside, seeing Dominski staring back at him through Zoom struck fear to the closer. She covers Tesla, among other companies, said a confident Horsley before the match, and she will bring that electrifying energy to our relay team. See what he did there? Being states away, each team was tasked with securing their own pie. NPR went with a mixed berry from Pie Vibes in Maryland, and the Register demolished a blueberry number made by Iowa State Fair Blue Ribbon winner Kathleen Bebot. Rules were that each pie had to be 9 inches in diameter, cut into 8 slices with a double crust top, because we all know lattice is just a garnish. During competition, eater's only reprieve from pie, as though you need a reprieve from pie, is a glass of water. Pie acquired, smack talked, the field was ready, packed with impressive eaters on both sides. Leading off for Team Register was digital editor Cecilia Hanley, a rookie to the spy eating game, but a natural who easily bested NPR's first contestant, Smokey Bear, who skirted clean plates rules by leaving nearly half the slice in his beard. Hansley's nascent eating game was buoyed by extra hydration prior to the feat and big bites, she said in a post-game interview. Team NPR made a swift comeback in the fourth round with Michael Zamora, a visual editor who employed the pizza pie system. Palm your piece like a New Yorker and bite centered across like you've got to catch a subway uptown. His quick work put No Pie Refused back into contention. With our lead dwindling, the signal was given for me to go. Normally, a devotee of the pizza pie method, I let my pie warm prior to the contest and quickly abandoned hope it would stay together in a transit from plate to mouth. Instead, I had to use the pinch and shovel approach, pecking at the pie like a chicken and craning the chunks to my face like I was getting the last crumbs out of a Doritos bag. Moraine dove into the Team Register's final piece, a mere bite or two ahead of Dominski, using his patented Hoover technique. His belief, as passed down by his mentees, is that there's really no need to involve hands when your face can meet the pie on the plate. With the uneasy confidence of Casey at the bat and Dominski making quick work of her slice, Moraine sucked the blueberry remnants off his thumb as teammates chanted for him to show his mouth to the judges, gosh dang it. In the nick of time he did, besting Dominski, this time. With Team NPR once again bridesmaids to our bride, Dominski said, though she started from behind, she held out hope in her heart for a comeback as she took her first bites. "You can't eat a piece of pie without believing in the possibility of the pie," she said. But about halfway through, I just saw hope die, and I had to persevere anyway. "I think I've built some character here," she said. "I'd like to think that's some really positive personal growth." Dejected but not down and out, Horsley promised his team will return to the battleground, adopting the slogan, "Next Year in Iowa." But more than cementing a pynasty, this rhubarb rumble reigned as a bright spot, a welcome breath of berry-scented air, in a world where gestures wildly is so disappointing. As I write this, eyes misty in celebration, I notice that my water bottle has been stained with purple pie filling, still gooey to the touch. That victory stickiness, I will covet it forever. This was written by Courtney Crowder, the Register's Iowa columnist, who traverses the state's 99 counties telling Iowan stories. She prefers gummy bears, but pie will do. Tyler Jett writes, "Iowa tied for fourth nationally in census response. Town of 73 is second in nation to achieve 100%. Balltown Mayor Sherry Sigworth believes she could convince all her constituents to fill out the census. To be fair, the task was a bit easier for her than for other city leaders. Located about 17 miles northwest of Dubuque, Balltown is a home to only 73 residents, a bar and a grill, a feed and seed store, and two Mississippi River Valley overlooks. The town was doing pretty well a month ago when 87% of the population had responded to the census, but Sigworth, age 43, believed she could close the gap. She sent a message to about 20 friends in a Facebook Messenger group chat. Those who didn't respond, she texted. Those who were older and not using Facebook, she called. And for those who needed more help, she showed up at their homes with her laptop, ready to help them fill out the form. On July 2nd, Balltown became the second city in the country with a 100% census response rate. The first was North River, North Dakota, population 55. "I know my community," Sigworth said. "When I saw we were at 87%, I thought, this is totally doable. And then when I saw we were at in the 90s, I knew we could do it. I'm really competitive." As a whole, Iowans have done a pretty good job responding to the census this year. The state has a 68.4% response rate thus far, tied with Michigan for fourth in the country. With several months before the deadline, the response is slightly behind Iowa's performance in 2010, when about 71% of the people filled out the form. The U.S. Census Bureau on Wednesday sent out its sixth postcard to the households that have not responded, one last reminder before census takers begin showing up at doors on August 11th. Residents have until October 31st to fill out the form on their own and turn it in by mail, phone, or online. Census takers will wear masks and carry badges and cell phones with the Bureau's logo on them. Census data helps determine state representation in the U.S. House of Representatives, and agencies use the information to determine funding for government programs. Census spokeswoman Maureen Schreiner said the best way for the state to rally more responses will be by following examples like Balltown's with active engagement among friends. "That's what needs to happen," she said. "It really is neighbor-to-neighbor outreach. Is there a family member I can talk to? Is there a friend? Are there people in my organization I need to reach out to?" In Polk County, the overall response rate has been similar to the state's as of a whole. Still, some neighborhoods are far behind the state average. Schreiner said many of those areas are in traditionally hard-to-count areas where there are high percentages of renters and lower-income residents. Matthew Gilbert, an attorney and member of the Iowa 2020 Census Complete Count Committee, said he was disappointed in the state's preparation for the count this year. "With a largely white population, Iowa has traditionally had among the best response rates in the country during the census, as is the case this year." But Gilbert said state leaders should have looked harder at neighborhoods where residents have not responded as frequently. Many of these areas are disproportionately Black, Latino, or Native American. In other states, governments have appropriated money to organizations like the NAACP to hire community members who can help their neighbors sign up for the census. That has not happened in Iowa. "There's a real, true, intentional need that has to happen," Gilbert said. "I think the legislators dropped the ball. Something anything would have been great to have for census outreach. In Polk County, a census tract in the Riverbend community has the lowest turnout rate so far, just 31%. About one-fourth of the residents are Latino, and the median household income is around $26,000, as compared to $66,000 for Polk County as a whole. Joe Henry, political director for the League of United Latin American Citizens of Iowa, said he is going to take a part-time job with the census to knock on doors. He said the census won't reach some in the community through the typical outreach methods like promotional posters and social media campaigns. He said the work is similar to that of a voter registration. It takes members of the community going door to door for several weeks to break down barriers. Without that field operation and just relying on social media and certain types of technology, it's not going to measure accurately working class people, Henry said. It's just not going to happen. And Sarah K. LeBlanc writes about Urbandale's Rolling Green Elementary start school year with online learning, 2-week extension given amid pandemic concerns. There were no tears in the drop-off line Thursday for the first day of the new school year at Urbandale's Rolling Green Elementary. There was no drop-off line at all. Instead, teachers and students fired up their laptops and kicked off the year with online greetings before starting lessons. The year-round elementary was expected to be one of the first schools in the state to welcome back students when classes began Thursday, but concerns over the COVID-19 pandemic caused the district to change course. "We had a great first day," interim principal Daniel Wilson said. "We obviously missed having the energy of the students in the building, but our teachers were so excited to connect with students even if it was through the computer today. It was great to go around the building to see so many smiling faces." In a message to families Tuesday, the school announced it had received permission from the Iowa Department of Education to begin the year in the online-only required continuous learning instruction model. The department granted permission for 2 weeks. After August 6, based on an assessment of the district and public health, the school said it will either request permission to continue online learning or shift to a hybrid model, which would involve online and in-person learning. Wilson said her teachers were given the option to work from home or from the Rolling Green school building. Most returned to their otherwise empty classrooms to virtually reconnect with their students. She said staffers do not have to wear masks when in their rooms. The Urbandale School Board voted July 13th to start the semester online at Rolling Green, but a decision on the district's remaining schools might not happen until mid-August, Superintendent Steve Bass said. "While we have been planning to start the school year with the in-person on-site instructional delivery model, we are in the process of collaborating with the Polk County Health Department to reassess this approach based on the current status of public health," Bass said in a letter to families on July 10th. School districts across Iowa have been asked by state education leaders to prepare for 3 scenarios this fall: students returning to school buildings, students attending 100% of their classes online or through remote learning alternatives, and a hybrid option that combines in-person classes with remote learning. The state expects districts to be prepared to change how students are taught based on local COVID-19 conditions. Urbandale's hybrid plan would include 2 days of in-person classes and 3 days for required remote lessons. Classes are set to begin August 25th at all other Urbandale schools. "In the days and weeks to come, we'll have more information available to share with families and staff regarding the various public health considerations that will be used to inform how we'll make our decisions," Bass said. And that does it for the first hour of the Register on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Up next, we'll give a shout-out to all our listeners who are celebrating a birthday today. I'm your reader, Dennis May. Thanks for listening.